Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and this is Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, my guest is an educator, a human rights activist, a filmmaker, and a trained therapist who's worked as a volunteer ambulance worker in Gaza alongside Palestinian paramedics and has also spent years in the West Bank.
A world, you know, of super yachts and a world of, you know, children going to sleep hungry and dying of malnourishment. And that is the shift, I think, that is happening. And that is, you know, whether that is a rage or a fierceness, a fierce love that is emerging in the collective consciousness now, that we can't go back to that status quo and we can't be numbed in a way by the drugs, you know, that of, you know, television content or online content, you know, that numbs people to this, that creates, you know, this distance of miles or of geography, or that tells us that we can, you know, take meaning from things that people, I think, on a very fundamental, ethical and soul level know are not enough. They're not enough to sustain the human spirit. They're not enough to sustain, you know, lives that are worth living. And lives that are worth living, I think we're all seeing, are lives of community, lives of care, lives of bearing witness, of truth, and lives of courage.
Caoimhe Butterley was born in Ireland to Irish parents who migrated to Canada when she was a baby and where she spent the first 10 years of her life. And then she lived in Mauritius and Zimbabwe for 8 years. She's worked with refugee and displaced communities for over 25 years in Palestine, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, Mexico, Guatemala, Haiti, Ukraine, Greece, Calais and elsewhere. And she currently works in psychosocial and trauma support work with humanitarian responders and refugee communities. In this conversation, she shares her perspective on the now, which includes the global shift in consciousness, the power and the benefit of connecting to like-minded people. She speaks of Palestinian joy and the importance of collective care. Here it is. Caoimhe, I'm so grateful that you have made yourself available for this conversation at this time. You speak from such a source of experience and wisdom and care. So when I hear you speak, I take so much from it. So I felt like now with all that's going on and the conversations I'm having in my personal life through people who message me on Instagram based on some content I might share, I think there's a need for people to feel seen and also to feel like what they're doing, if they're involved in whatever that looks like for them, that it matters and what they're doing is important. So thank you for making yourself available today.
A pleasure.
Tadhg Hickey actually shared something today. Tadhg, for those listening, you probably, a lot of people listening to this conversation are probably aware of him. He's a comedian and he's also an incredible voice and has been for quite some time. But I've really seen him, his work, I suppose, just really activate and step up over the past number of months. But he shared something today that I shared on my own page about this is not a fad. And I really feel that it is something. I've had these chats as well with people going, how are you doing? And how, like, there's a huge shift happening in a lot of us. And it's, we're not on our own, which is a positive thing. Like, we're feeling this very, very deeply. Kate O'Dwyer, who was previously on the podcast, who luckily has become a pal as well. Yeah. She said, I feel like I'm changing, or I've changed at a cellular level. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
You know, this is not a, okay, this is the way it is right now. We're going to go back to our normal lives and everything's going to be the way it was. It feels like we're never going to go back to the way it was. And I know for you, you've been in this work for decades. And it's not that I was completely oblivious to it. I was aware, but it was this, it felt like it was this place far, far away. And I think through the imagery and the connection and feeling connected to the people that we're now following, like the likes of Bissan and all these people that you feel like they've become your friends and you care for them and you see their turmoil, their torture, and what they're sharing, and you're like, this is happening to my pal.
Yes. And it's perhaps that intimacy, because it is so intimate, that in a way, you know, if one of the strategies behind the blocking of access to international foreign correspondence, you know, was to try and almost smother or obfuscate, you know, news coming out of Gaza, it's actually had the opposite effect, you know, because it has created this enormous platform, you know, for these young, profoundly courageous, you know, heartfelt journalists, you know, covering with nuance, you know, with invested care, you know, their context, their people, their land. I think, you know, with a weave that would be absent, you know, were those pieces covered by international correspondents who, yes, you know, use local fixers, but it's not the same. And people are telling their own stories in a way that marks a profound shift in terms of how a siege like this has been covered in the past, you know, the relentless onslaught of the past 5 months. But I think what you referred to, you know, in terms of, and what Kate, you know, gave such eloquent voice to in terms of that shift on a cellular level, I think it comes from a place of recognition and knowing, because the expressions of distress that so many activists, you know, similarly are coming to me with, you know, messages of sometimes despair. I feel I've already lived, you know, 20 something years ago and then 18 years ago, like through five sort of onslaughts and then wars, you know, in other contexts. And if anything, that lived experience of having been there, having mourned, you know, feeling that overwhelm, that pain, you know, that outrage, that despair sometimes that this can happen on our watch repetitively. I think when you survive that and recognize, you know, that for all of this horror, you know, it's that I think of sometimes almost a lens, you know, the expanded lens, the contracted lens, just like our bodies are expanding and contracting, you know, as we watch these pixelated images of horror, you know, through the contraction of our telephones, you know, the intimacy and yet, you know, the loneliness of that witness. But I feel if anything, sort of that survival of on a personal level, you know, which pales, always, always pales in comparison to the intergenerational massacres, you know, that are happening in Gaza, you know, to people who are losing every loved being, you know, that they were emotionally invested in, you know, that who cared for them, who, you know, held all of those pieces of loyalty, you know, and protection that families can hold, and suddenly they're alone, you know, in a very cruel world. So I say this recognizing that whatever I've experienced pales in comparison to that. But simultaneously having lost many friends along the way, having witnessed, you know, the deliberate and systematic targeting of paramedic, you know, brothers that I worked with and alongside in Gaza, in Jenin, in Lebanon, in Iraq, having worked in Ukraine, in Haiti, in all of these contexts. I think what one learns is, you know, first of all, the fragility of life. But the closer you come to your own mortality, the more near-death experiences I think that you survive. It equips one to be able to be present, but also to hold that space. So to be present in the immediacy and the pain of this, but also to hold a space of hope. And I think there's a lot of Palestinians in the diaspora who are speaking continually to this, right? To really try and inhabit and embody the freedom call that is coming out of Gaza vis-a-vis Palestine, but also that internal freedom call. What does it mean to live an examined life? What does it mean to live a life in which we are bearing witness to and receptive and accountable to the suffering of others? And one little phrase that I read online before coming in here today en route, it was this beautiful graphic, I think, shared by Just Seeds in the States. And it talked about how far away wars can seem until you put your ear down to the earth and you feel the earth trembling, you know, with the indignance of the one simple truth, you know, within all of this, is that you don't kill children, you don't murder children, and that this is happening on our watch, nor adults, nor elders, but that so many children, you know, I think more than anything, when I have conversations with women I know stepping into this space, it is that, you know, and for all of the swirl of a media sometimes that can seek to diminish, you know, just that clarity of so many people stepping into this space saying no, but also saying our yeses. And I think one of our yeses and one of the calls in all of this is to hold that space of hope within all of this. Because no matter how far away Palestinian and other freedoms can seem in the immediacy of this horror, step by painful step, people will survive. If I have any practices within this, it is to intentionally look for almost those little sprouts of hope. And those lighthouses, you know, are evident in, you know, from, I think, of Palestinians, you know, in the diaspora, in exile and refugee camps across the region, watching this and the profound disempowerment, you know, the pain, the survivor's guilt, the vicarious trauma, all of the layers of that, but continuing, you know, to show up, to demonstrate, to gather people. I think of Jewish Americans, this amazingly brave emergent generation of young organizers and older ones too, rabbinical students, you know, rabbis, etc., but who are reclaiming the social justice imperative within Judaism, you know, and who are on the front line of blockading and dissenting and speaking that truth to power.
It's so powerful.
So powerful. So that in our movements, all of the allies stepping into this space, but I also look for examples of hope from Gaza. And the example today that I saw was this little boy who planted these little seedlings outside of his tent because he said he wanted to make his home beautiful. And it was just an image of him watering his plants. And I think sometimes, you know, maybe the reason that I think a lot of people that I know who have spent time in Gaza, whether they are Palestinians or, you know, those of us who have had the privilege of spending some time there, it is easier to hold hope when you've been there because our minds are not just occupied and colonized by these images of horror and massacre and rubble. We also have memories of the beauty of Gaza, you know, of families olive harvesting or, you know, Deir Bala or Jabalia or Beit Hanun, you know, of people making food and showing hospitality to neighbors, of subversive humor. I think of the cynicism of some of, you know, the paramedic colleagues I used to work alongside, many of whom have been killed in the past 5 months. I think of the elders, you know, and the oral histories that they pass down to young, you know, parkour runners and surfers, you know, and clowns and, you know, the jesters that always emerge in extreme adversity. And the artists, you know, the truth tellers, the workers, the builders. And in a way, you know, there is that call for us now not to diminish the potentiality, even if it seems so far away, but a Palestinian joy and a Palestinian life beyond survival. And I think people like Bissan, you know, in exposing her vulnerability and her courage, but also her care, you know, are teachers within this, you know, how to hold the duality of all of this, the pain, but also the love. And that love is so radiant. And I think that is what is drawing people, perhaps who have never been in a space of demonstrations, into demonstrations, because instead of them seeming, you know, a place of high activation, I think, to the nervous system, which sometimes demonstrations can be, I think they are actually soothing for people because there's community in them.
Yeah.
And to hear,
you know, really felt that.
Totally. To hear your no echoed, that no echoed by, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of other people is so affirming in the truth of this.
I remember feeling, you know, different emotions on the way up on the bus. And I was nervous and I was a little bit excited, and I was looking forward to meeting some pals and make new ones, which I did. But I found it to be so powerful, extremely moving. But it felt like I was channeling all those different emotions that I have and had into, at least I'm now joining people who are, we're all feeling the same feelings. And there was a power in that. There was a real power in that.
There's a profound power in that, and channeling the feelings. And in a way, if we bring it back, channeling the ancestors, you know, I think specifically vis-a-vis Ireland, this island, and broader, you know, social movements that have shifted, you know, status quos of injustice throughout history have always had the dissenters. You know, it has always been a catalyst for people, you know, whether it's the one person, the five people, I think of women, you know, specifically, you know, and the comfort suddenly of hearing, you know, your internal conversation articulated through that megaphone in that context, you know, through shared conversations, through a common language, you know, of dissent. It is so validating, I think, for people. And then that shift, you know, to Palestine, to Gaza, and then beyond, you know, the lens that this is giving people, you know, vis-a-vis, I'm thinking on, you know, my walk here in the rain past the IPO, you know, and the over 100 men from so many different geographies, you know, of exile, of suffering, of all of the sacrifices of that journey, now sleeping rough, you know, in the unwelcome of systems, you know, that fail to respond to people's basic and immediate needs, and then broader needs and broader rights. You know, but I thought, even while, you know, while downstairs before we came up, the television was on in the studio, and I had to turn it off because at this stage there's something about the speed of things like television, the speed of the faff, that tells us that, you know, that tells society in order to be happy that one needs to consume, you know, whether that's consuming products, whether that's consuming, you know, dumbed down messaging around what we should strive to in this life, what can bring meaning, you know, to our lives. And if anything, it feels like in this moment of this paradigm shift, because it is a paradigm shift, you know, and it's a paradigm shift that is not coming quickly enough for Palestinians under siege in Gaza.
Yeah.
It is not bringing, you know, translating into one ambulance, you know, being able to reach, you know, a six-year-old surrounded by the bodies of, you know, her family of Hind. It's not translating into anything that provides a protective shield for that young mother and her two twins.
Yeah.
You know, it is not translating into mechanisms or measures that bring food to children that are going to sleep every night through enforced famine. And it's not keeping them safe. And there is a failure within that collectively, that we cannot translate our dissent, our grief, our solidarity, our love into systemic political change. However, I feel that this movement stops for no one, you know, and this river of life, you know, this arc towards justice will continue, and it will continue, you know, in the memories and the conviction of that little boy who is watering his saplings of hope, of beauty outside of his tent. It will continue, you know, in the lived memory of people like Bisen, you know, who entered this, you know, already a survivor of five other onslaughts plus a siege, but who emerges from this a leader. You know, I think of people like Nora Arakat, you know, in the US, and, you know, her profound commitment, the graft, you know, intergenerationally, throughout the decades that she and those who have walked before her have done in terms of making those alliances, you know, within social movements, within movements for migrant justice, for racial justice, you know, within the US, and then broadening that out, and all of these alliances that are going on intermovement now. But there's something around the speed of the world, of economic systems that are profoundly failing people, that are enriching a minority and impoverishing a majority, that people are also saying no to. And they're saying no to, I think, a status quo in which we can walk, you know, by the tents of the vulnerability of those men, you know, sleeping away from families in the cold, neglected and marginalized, into a yes of solidarity. And even when I was there, you know, people were showing up with tents, you know, with whatever they could bring in the back of their cars. And that shift, you know, which has already existed, it's always existed on a community level. You know, when communities are in crisis, people will band together, you know, they'll walk together and they'll respond. But the shift that is happening, I think, is that people are seeing themselves in the other in such a deep, intimate and immediate way that people can look at, you know, people in Gaza as sisters, as brothers, and as children, you know, and that, you know, when I first heard it, you know, articulated by Palestinians, it was actually a doctor and a paramedic in Al-Shifa Hospital, when there were children who were mourning their parents and mourning their loneliness, keening, you know, wailing for their mother and fathers who were killed in both cases, buried under the rubble with their siblings. They were sole survivors, wounded sole survivors. And I just remember in Arabic, these two men saying to the children, you're our children now. And it's something that I've witnessed in the demonstrations, you know, just the grief that people are holding around this. And it feels like they are, you know, and yes, what does that translate into in the sense of when you cannot provide any of the practical solidarity, emotional support, all of the things that people just want to envelop, you know, the over 17,000 children now without family, you know, without immediate family or parents or a parent in Gaza. But what it will translate into, I think, is a steely commitment in people that no longer, you know, can those, you know, who occupy places of power, be immune to this, and that it's not good enough, you
it's
know,
not good enough, no.
And particularly in Ireland, you know, yes, better than other countries, thankfully, but the bar is so low, you know, that we have to commend, you know, even the most basic statements of support to call for a ceasefire, the bare minimum of what we should be calling for and what we should be enacting as a country. And it's a good start, but it's not enough. And maybe, you know, in terms of another source of hope, I just think of, you know, this generation that you see, that I see, you know, on the streets, whether, you know, they're blockading bridges or boycotting or doing their teach-ins in universities. And I saw this beautiful one from Brown University in the States, again, of young Jewish students and allies singing about intergenerational traumatic repair. And it was such a beautiful song. And I just thought, more of this, more song, more culture, you know, more beauty in our nose. But in 10 years' time, you know, they will be the journalists. They will be, some of them, perhaps, you know, in politics. They will be the carers, and, you know, the artists and the the writers and the thinkers. And this awakening is not going away.
I had that conversation with my partner about, would I feel the same, you know, if we hadn't had kids, you know, would I have the same fire that I feel now? I think I would. And I suppose, yeah, you don't know, right? You don't know, because you can't imagine a life that you don't have. But I definitely feel that an added element for me is that it's not just about me. It's about wanting to, you know, hopefully set a healthy example for my kids. That what I'm doing, and it's not much, I don't feel it's half enough, but what I'm doing is a normal response to horror. Yeah. That shutting it off and ignoring and carrying on isn't. Now, I'm obviously extremely mindful because my kids are very, very young, 6 and 2. Like, they're not aware of a lot. I do protect them from a lot of it. Mm. And I'm very aware of when I consume content, even online, if I'm around them, I try and be present with them. And I find that when they're in bed, often that's when I allow the floodgates to open. But I definitely feel that's a big part of it, because this is important work for us to do as individuals, but it's also the people that we can potentially impact around us, whether it's people within our families or friends or the next generation that we are rearing.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
It is important. And I think it's the responsibility piece within that as well, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, sort of things circulating online sort of saying, you know, what we're doing now is what we would have done in the face of profound historical injustices or oppressions. You know, if one ever asked oneself the question, what would you do in this time, were one alive, you know, you're doing it now. And I think there is that piece of, you know, that bearing of witness, you know, that modeling for children, that when they feel something instinctually is wrong, that they feel that power, you know, to be able to respond. And certainly having spent time with a lot of children, you know, both refugee children who are engaged in these long, perilous journeys, you know, to safety and life's a more possibility and dignity, you know, by sea, over mountains, etc. But also children, you know, who are born to the passport privilege of being born in a country with rights, you know, and, you know, with obviously a lot of inequality as well, but with, you know, the right to live without fear of a sniper or a bomb, or now in Ireland, obviously not historically. But there's something in that, I think, about that instinctive wisdom of children, not to romanticize it, but I've seen it time and time again. And I was walking with my 12-year-old by the sea the other day, and he has come with me. He comes with me to a lot of refugee camp contexts that I work in. He's, you know, been to Palestinian camps in Lebanon and Jordan, and broader sort of refugee camps for people from lots of different contexts, from Congo to Sudan to Eritrea to Syria, etc. In Greece, we just came back from one actually a couple of weeks ago. And he, amongst other things, as we were walking, was saying, you know, Mama, wouldn't it just be better if, you know, if kids could just rule this world? And I thought, oh, yes, you know, and on multiple levels. But I think also on a nervous system level, there are a whole process in terms of rupture and repair when it comes to, you know, human relationship, to communication. But also they're so in their bodies, and they validate what they're feeling in their bodies, feelings of unease or trust or safety or, you know, untrust sometimes, but also witness. And sometimes when I spend time, you know, with Ty, my son, in different camp contexts, the questions that he'll have at the end of the day, you know, through witnessing securitized camps or the subtle humiliations, you know, of enforced dependency, or the courage of people, or the creativity, or the extreme contrast that at the end, you know, of a couple of months in a camp, we can get on a plane and be back home in hours, whereas his friends, you know, end up sleeping rough in forests on the Balkan route. And they stay in touch, you know, so at the very least, I hope for him, it's never abstract, you know, it's embodied through his own relationships and friendships. But there is something within all of this, when I refer to the nervous system, that I think is so important for us all to hold in these times. And that is, you know, that this impacts, you know, this absorption, this metabolizing of so much horror, of the injustice, of the pain, of the trauma, of the grief, of the suffering. And within this, you know, to recognize the humility of our bodies and the wisdom of our bodies. Mm. And by that, I mean, you know, when our systems are flooded with cortisol and adrenaline, flooded with grief, that there's such an importance in tending, you know, in the same way that we try and tend with care to those that we love, whether that is in the immediacy of our own families, our communities, our friendships. And now within this movement, a deep, you know, and vital love vis-a-vis Palestinians and all of those who experience oppression. But to try and internalize a little bit of that care in terms of the sustainability of, you know, our strong and robust and simultaneously vulnerable and fragile bodies, yeah, psyches and spirits within all of this. And when sometimes when I step into organizing spaces, if one just drops into almost, you know, one's gut or one's body, yeah, I oftentimes think of, you know, really basic psychoeducational concepts such as co-regulation, you know, when we're around people who are regulated or sort of calm or in a spacious place, it has an impact. One oftentimes feels calm, you know, or calmer.
Yeah.
And when you're around people, you know, who are in distress for totally legitimate reasons, that sometimes you can feel, you know, your heart rate increasing, that clench, that constricted sort of chest,
for sure,
breath, your stomach. And certainly in my experience of working in humanitarian contexts with people who too often are casualties of this work, you know, human rights and humanitarian social justice contexts, I just think of how these systems also make people expendable. And that's even, you know, I think of larger humanitarian organizations who have good intent when it comes to psychosocial resourcing of staff and workers and volunteers. But translating that into embedded sort of systemic practice, you know, is sometimes the missing piece. And I'm thinking here of people, you know, who maybe who will work in a war or very intense context or a search and rescue context in the Central Mediterranean. And after that witness and that grief, they come home and they're given 6 sessions, you know, perhaps or more, with a therapist who maybe doesn't have a lived experience of the context that they're trying to articulate. So they have to do the education piece with a therapist,
yeah,
to begin with before they can delve. But it's the peer-to-peer piece that is missing oftentimes, because that solidarity that you spoke of, you know, in the bus, that feeling of the collective, oftentimes is what keeps people going, working in different contexts, the team, the friendships, the camaraderie, the collective experience, the fact that they don't have to explain what they're feeling sometimes because somebody else is also holding a piece of that.
Certainly, yeah.
And then they come home and they're back in a world in which there's a television on that is bombarding them, you know, with messages around consumption or, you know, reductive news that they know doesn't accurately reflect the context that they've just mm-hmm. witnessed and the mm-hmm. injustice of that, you know, and the speed, the sensory sort of overload of living in cities. And that's when I think, you know, sometimes the trauma, the moral injury piece, sometimes the burnout, you know, really sets in. So I'm saying all of this just to loop back to the piece around sustainability.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, continually listening to the wisdom of our bodies when our bodies are telling us, you know, we're feeling overwhelmed or we need to get off the phone. We need to step away from that, to walk by the sea, to regulate, to run, to dance, you know, to cook nurturing food for oneself and one's, you know, family or people or friends, just to allow oneself to have the right to do that.
Yeah. And it's not selfish to do that.
No.
It's necessary.
It is necessary. And it's part of, if you look at social movements in the global south, they have that so interwoven. You know, there is food, there is dance, there is celebration, there is community care, and it's intergenerational. And that's what I feel is sometimes lacking in our movements, that there is shame and there's guilt around the pause. But I think, and I've spoken about this with Ruth and other beautiful friends who sing who that is their medium of expression and creating beauty and some joy in the world. And I think oftentimes of a beautiful friend and Palestinian Canadian human rights solicitor, Diana Boutou. And at the beginning of this, I remember back, well, not the beginning of this, the continuation of the 75 years, but the beginning of this particular chapter of this horror 5 months ago, she spoke about a choir of dissent and a choir of resistance. And she referred specifically within that choir of dissent to the need to pause and the need to take breath and the need to self and collectively resource. And even if there can be that little feeling of shame or guilt around it, to do it, but to actually take that breath and that pause with the confidence in a choir that somebody else will keep on singing.
And then, I love that.
Yes, and when then that person also feels that overwhelm or that grief or that pain, you know, or that just that nervous system on fire and needs to take breath and self or collectively resource, they can do so with that feeling of confidence that somebody else is going to keep on singing that dissent and singing, you know, that outrage and that love and that grief. And within our choir, you know, it's really trying to think of, and I think to take leadership from movements, Indigenous movements, human rights movements, of people who have walked this walk intergenerationally, ancestrally, far before we. And what they do, you know, is they tend, you know, to that collective ecosystem of care. You know, they bring in the things that nurture, the things that keep hope alive, the things that keep imagination alive. There is so much music and song and color. And sometimes when I go to demonstrations, you know, it's shifting now, I think, but in Western Europe, I just think, where is the music? Where is the celebration? Where is the theater? Where are those access points that, you know, families out pushing their babies and their strollers can say, I can step into this space and I'm safe, you know, and I think there's a time for everything. There is a time for outrage and there's a time, you know, for the slogans that we need and for the clenched fists. And then there's times that clenched fist, you know, can be held in a heart space, you know, of the courage and the tending to each other. And alongside that, part of this, I really feel deeply and viscerally, is in a way examining what I, at this stage in my life, view as almost this internalization of quite a patriarchal sort of framing around self-care and collective care, that is somehow less than, you know, the urgency of the street, the urgency of the mobilization. And I don't believe it's both, you know, that it can be both and, that you can be every bit as effective, responsive, urgent in your actions, but that you're continually dropping down into a space of regulation, of as much calm as possible. And also, you know, of that long arc, that our movements don't need more casualties. They don't need more people burning out. And then suffering, you know, in isolation, you know, because people do, they retreat then, and there's, you know, the guilt and the shame around feeling that overwhelm, feeling that exhaustion.
Because it feels
like...
Which
is human.
Yeah, which is human. And I would imagine burnout is common.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
As you said, it is the listening to the body. And if you don't, and you're going against your instinct, and you're driven by, you know, I suppose wanting to do good, which is powerful and brilliant and beautiful. But if you're going against then what your body is trying to tell you, it probably will lead to just a crash.
And it does oftentimes when it doesn't have to.
Yeah. You know. So this is why this is really important. And certainly what you've spoken about there as well is something I have absolutely found huge comfort in, is the connections that have been made. People who just get it. You don't even have to explain. They just, you know, you meet them or you chat to them or you voice note them and they just get it.
Yeah. And it's intuitive.
Yeah.
You know? And that's where I think, you know, it's maybe a word that I overuse, you know, without sort of explaining what I mean. But when I say spiritual, you know, it is that seeing of each other. And there's so much meaning, you know, to be derived from that, you know, to be in community, you know, with people of like mind, of, you know, similar emotional registers around this, and not to have to explain anything, just to feel sort of seen and heard, and for the people that you're with to feel seen and heard. And the beauty of that, you know, because it is something very precious, I think, in our lifetimes to find tribe, you know, around this. And tribe that is not prescriptive or polemical or judgmental, you know, that also is spacious and caring enough, you know, that it can invite people into that arc of understanding and that arc of, you know, of education. And I think that is the challenge too, no matter how much one learns about this, you know, context vis-a-vis Palestine or others, to always have the humility and the graciousness, you know, never to, I think, judge those who are in the beginning of that journey. And that is hard, you know, and I don't mean people who are adversarial to our messages vis-a-vis justice and rights, but people who are just beginning, you know, in titrated doses, you know, to be able to learn. But I would think, just going back to the point specifically about, you know, how do we respond to all of this? And in a way, I think of Muhammad Ali, actually, and I think of sort of floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee. And in a way, that's become a personal mantra within all of this, like, you know, that the sting is the collective action, you know, and by stinging, I don't mean something that is injurious to others, but I do mean, you know, it's that critical mass of just that no. And then the floating like a butterfly is not detached in the way that I sort of visualize it. But it is being able to flow in and out of spaces, you know, because activist spaces have all of their neurosis and their eco-politic and all of the things as well, which fortunately has been very absent over the last 5 months because of the urgency of this. But none of us come into this as blank slates. You know, we all carry our, you know, our lived histories, families of origins for some people, you know, if that experience was hard, families of created community, triggers, you know, all of the things. And something to me about floating like a butterfly is just having patience with that, you know, just recognizing people are people and we can be complex sometimes. And, you know, and sometimes people can be frustrating and, but just to cut people a little bit of slack, you know, as well.
Well, I'm fully aware that I'm sitting with you here, somebody who has dedicated decades of their life to this work. And I'm just a fresh newbie. I'm like, I'm like a newborn. I'm like a little baby chick. I'm like just starting my journey. No, but it's not that I wasn't aware. It's not that. But as I said, it was the distance thing. It was the out there-ness of it. And that this time has taught me of, okay, this is happening. This is happening in a place not that far away at all, actually. And if we're allowing this to happen, and it is happening and it's continuing to happen, you know, what does it actually say about the rest of the world and about us and our part in it and all of the layers that go with that? But I think you've also hit on something else that would be really important to explore, because I do have to check myself sometimes, and sometimes I don't check myself enough, or I don't do it in time, where I had this recently, like literally a few days ago on my Instagram, where I was full of rage. It was after the flower massacre.
Yes.
It was, you know, seeing, as you said, forced starvation. It was all coming at me. Then I was seeing the images of starving little bodies. Yeah. So it was all of this coming at me, and I started to feel this rage build up. And my kids are safe asleep in bed, which is where all kids should be at nighttime.
Yeah.
And I always reassure them that feeling of they're loved and they're safe, because that's what they need, they deserve, all kids do. And that feeling of, I cannot get my head around that feeling that as a parent that you can't tell your kid that they're safe, that they're okay, and that they're going to be minded. I cannot get my head around that. But anyway, this had all come at me and I just felt this rage. So I bawled, and then that was replaced with fury.
Yeah.
So I took to my phone and I allowed my emotions to take over, and I did do what I suppose I'm aware of not doing, which is, and I know that shaming somebody into action is never going to achieve the results that you're hoping for, in the sense that calling people out or pointing the finger at somebody by saying, you know, why are you not, you know, speaking up about this, is not necessarily effective either. But I suppose sometimes, and I suppose it's just a reflection of the rawness and the realness of the now, which I'd love to see more people tap into, is that we are living through phenomenally difficult times. Yeah. And I feel like this is a wake up call for a lot of people. It's certainly been a huge one for me. And while I feel I'm very new and I'm finding my feet, and I'm fully aware of how much I have to learn and unlearn, actually, as the case is, huge amount of unlearning also required. I suppose there's a feeling of sometimes wondering what's going on in other people's minds. Maybe they're just not showing it to me, but I don't see at
you
times.
Don't see it.
I don't see it. And I wonder
what's
going on. I can't understand it, I suppose, when I know so many others are feeling it and feeling it so deeply.
Yes. And fury is okay. Fury is such a human reaction to this, particularly that day, but every day, you know, every video that we're watching, of course there's rage. And I think, you know, how do we translate rage into fierceness? And it almost feels like that's the call of this moment. How do we translate the grief, you know, the pain, the anger, the outrage into truth-telling fierceness? And in a way, I think, you know, I mean, who knows the arc of life, et cetera, but I think people step into spaces like you've stepped into, not only, you know, when they're ready, you know, and it doesn't mean that people have to know all everything when they, or learn or unlearn everything before they step into that space. But I just think to cut yourself a little bit of slack too, in the sense of a life path, that you're in a position now, you know, where you have built up an audience and a platform that you are using so beautifully and so loyally in this moment, you know. And I think, you know, vis-a-vis, because I get it, I don't move in sort of circles of, you know, sort of, I don't mean influencers to diminish everybody who shares online content, because I think there's a lot of beautiful content out there. But I do feel, if anything, these times have also, for many people, highlighted the vacuousness of celebrity culture and these projections of desired heroism and humanity on people who are not showing up at the time when it's most needed.
Oh yeah, that's it. Wow, that's
and
really it.
And it's okay to feel rage and disappointment and frustration and a fierce rejection of that. And it's not good enough. And I feel at this stage, if people aren't ready to step into this space for whatever reason, that can be fear, that can be, you know, I know some people who I found, you know, people that I don't know personally, but who I followed for years, who I can't follow, I can't digest it anymore. You know, just that disparity between what's, you know, being shared and what is being lived by people. But I do feel, you know, when people, for a variety of different reasons, whether they have, you know, care responsibilities or bereavements or just have been in a space where they can't step into this, okay. But don't keep on producing content or sharing content that invisibilizes this, that you know, operates off a playbook and a page that maybe existed 5 minutes, you know, 5 months ago for some people in this world, not very many when you look at the percentages of people, you know, who I think subscribe or project, you know, these understandings of heroism or humanity on celebrities, you know, compared to, you know, and maybe that's, I, again, had the luxury of having spent my entire adult life, you know, from 17, 18 years old and pre that, vis-a-vis the countries that I grew up in, but of always being surrounded by people who embody that heroism and that humanity. And those are paramedics and those are, you know, people, communities that get up every day, you know, and continue to insist on life, continue to resist, you know, the inequalities, the oppressions, you know, whether they're indigenous communities or refugee communities or displaced communities, but who continue to speak that truth to power. But I do feel for a whole cross-section of society now, I don't think people are projecting those qualities on people that they see online anymore, other than people like Bisan, you know, and Maltas and many others, the paramedics, you know, who cradle the broken bodies of children in Gaza and in other contexts as if they were their own, because they are. And having worked alongside Palestinian paramedics, throughout different onslaughts, that is something that I witnessed time and time again, the sacredness of that care work, that nobody was pulled out of the rubble, that we pulled nobody out of the rubble without there being, you know, just that weave of that sacred care work, you know, the attempt to try and give people a burial that had even an iota of dignity, you know. And that is something I think, you know, that has, it's just, it's shifted a consciousness. And I think there's a pre these last few months reality, which doesn't in any way negate that there are so many struggles, you know, that don't receive this amount of attention. I'm thinking of Sudan and Congo and multiple other simultaneous contexts.
Yeah.
But the stakes in this, you know, the perverse discourses, you know, that are so interwoven with untruths, you know, with cynical manipulations, you know, of what we know to be true, which again just keeps on looping back, you know, to that one simple truth that you do not murder children or their parents or their carers, you know, you do not bomb hospitals, you do not bomb schools, and, you know, all of the other, you know, just cascade of interlocking injustices that are going on within this. But it is a time of witness, and it is a time, I feel, of the truth tellers, a time of healers, you know, and a time of community within that. And that is a community that will translate long term into, I think, eventual Palestinian freedom, but also into that collective freedom, you know, that has been referred to at this stage. I'm thinking of Miriam and many others, you know, over the years who have borne witness to the fact, you know, that Palestine has freed them, you know, and freed them too, I think, from being content and complicit in a world, you know, of such profound inequality and such profound brutality, living simultaneously around this potential for beauty, this potential for there being enough for everyone, you know, enough to feed everyone, a world, you know, of super yachts and a world of, you know, children going to sleep hungry and dying of malnourishment. And that is the shift, I think, that is happening. And that is, you know, whether that is a rage or a fierceness, a fierce love that is emerging in the collective consciousness now, that we can't go back to that status quo and we can't be numbed in a way by the drugs, you know, that of, you know, television content or online content, you know, that numbs people to this, that creates, you know, this distance of miles or of geography, or that tells us that we can, you know, take meaning from things that people, I think, on a very fundamental, ethical and soul level know are not enough. They're not enough to sustain the human spirit. They're not enough to sustain, you know, life's that are worth living and lives that are worth living, I think we're all seeing are lives of community, lives of care, lives of bearing witness, of truth, and lives of courage. And that is what I see. I see so much courage, you know, in people who are standing with their tattered sign outside an embassy, you know, saying beep for Gaza. And they stand there in the rain, you know, in their sodden shoes, you know, and they get their 50 beeps and, you know, and but they feel they go home maybe a little bit exhausted, but also feeling a rest that they didn't feel before they went out, you know, just with that turmoil of absorbing and metabolizing the horror. And that is the call, you know, it's a call to show up, and a call to speak that truth to power. And whereas before, I think this used to be the preserve of, you know, campaign groups or social movements or activist groups, it feels like it's being collected, you know, or carried as a collective responsibility now in a way that I've certainly never witnessed, you know. And, you know, and I speak to 25 years of engagement in this versus, you know, those who have lived this 75 years, you know, intergenerationally in their families, in their homes, in their communities. But even as an ally, you know, watching this has been, you know, A, horrific, and B, profoundly inspiring as well, just to see that light, you know, the lighthouses that we're all taking hope from, you know, just beaming so strong to each other. And oftentimes, whenever I go into a place like you described after you put your children to bed, of just that collapse, you know, that grief, you know, which I try and be careful around, just because I think having worked, you know, between Palestine and Syria and Ukraine and Lebanon and Iraq and Haiti, and, you know, having subsumed, absorbed so many stories of grief for so long, I have to be careful too, you know, just that I can channel the grief effectively.
Okay.
But when I do, you know, when I do sob, as we're all sobbing, you know, I constantly pivot back to just imagining, you know, this night, you know, with its stars, but also the storm, this tumultuous sort of storm at sea that we're all bearing witness to in different ways. And then I imagine, you know, these sort of little fishing boats, each carrying these sort of strings of light, and that sometimes we can see each other, you know, sort of in the distance in this journey. And then lighthouses that are beaming, whether Palestinian Americans, Jewish Americans. I think that some of the families of the survivors of October the 7th, you know, also saying not in our name, not in their names. I think of Palestinians, you know, in camps. And then I think of our movements, you know, on the streets as allies as well, responding, you know, to that light emanating from Gaza. And for me, that light personally is the light emanating from what I heard described as the temples of humanity, which are hospitals and clinics and the backs of ambulances, you know, the mobile clinics and tents, you know, that a lot of healthcare workers are now doing in places like Rafah and Deir Bala and Khan Yunis. But there is something, again, so sacred in that care work, you know, that the healthcare workers, whether the over 600 that have been deliberately and systematically targeted in these 5 months, the hundreds that have been killed in other onslaughts, but also those who survive and who get up every day, despite the fact that their families, you know, could be targeted and are also at risk. And they just do this care, you know, of minding, you know, the children whose limbs have been, you know, amputated, of minding those, you know, who, when hospitals are under threat of more bombardment, who refuse to leave and they stay there with their patients and they do that sacred care work. And I feel there's a call from those temples of humanity to all of us, you know, bobbing in those fishing boats with our little strings of lights, our little voices of truth and witness, you know, but to internalize their care work with each other, with ourselves, with our families, you know, with our friends, and to recognize that this is our strength. You know, it is a no, a profound no, but it is so many yeses to the world, you know, which we want to collectively co-create. And I think of Arundhati Roy in this, you know, and her beautiful quote about another world is coming, and that she can hear her whisper, you know, almost. And I feel that so deeply these days. You know, there is and not in an idealistic way, not in a Pollyanna-esque way, because there is so much pain to come. We know this, you know, in terms of conflicts, you know, in terms of war onslaughts, you know, the normalization of practices of genocide, you know, that has been mainstreamed over the last 5 months, you know, climate change, world on fire, so many things.
Yeah.
But there is also, I think, a counter movement of people who refuse to be complicit in this, and whose love is emanating, you know, as another one of those lighthouses to be found and nurtured. And even if that light diminishes sometimes, if people get distracted or, but just to have that as a really central compass to how we navigate, you know, the world, ourselves, our relationships, our communities. And just to take courage from it, because we are the majority. And it may not seem like that sometimes these days when we look at positions on a, you know, on a political and governmental level that are irrepresentative of that. But we are the majority in this world. And it's translating that. Yeah. As many a spiritual, you know, I'm thinking from the south of the US, you know, has spoken to, but it's listening to those archives of resistance that have become co-opted into days that strip them of their meaning or but you know, the change that they were calling for, you know, vis-a-vis the civil rights struggle, vis-a-vis movements against slavery, vis-a-vis, you know, movements against dispossession and exile and oppression and exploitation throughout history, you know, those have been strong truth tellers who oftentimes were shunned and marginalized in their times.
Sinead O'Connor being one of them.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt.
Yeah.
May her prophetic voice, continue to inspire.
Absolutely. Caoimhe, thank you so much. I didn't realise how much I needed this conversation until, you know, I've been lucky enough to have it with you. And I'm so glad that those who will tune in will get to feel this too. Your words are going to stay with me for a very, very long time. I look forward to re-listening to this conversation, actually. So I'm so grateful that you said yes to this. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you. And keep harsh. Yeah, it's there is beauty to be found everywhere, always.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please check out previous episodes with Ruth Smith, Daniel Matte and Dr. Miriam Francois. And if you like what I do, please support the podcast by leaving a little comment or giving a rating. Thank you so much for listening to Ready to Be Real.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.